dance, why we're finally buoyant with joy, swooshing our limbs into snow angels as if our respective worlds hadn't fallen apart this past year. Sometimes I think that our grief bound us together tighter than if we hadn't faced loss within months of one another. Like he could know my insides how I knew his insides, and without that, maybe we'd have stumbled when we had stupid fights, usually when he was tired or I was feeling ungenerous, or when I had days when I went to call my mom and wound up purging my guts over a toilet, or he had moments when he disappeared so far into himself that he couldn't hear me, see me, listen to me, even if I was right there by his side on the couch, just staring at his hands without blinking, or staring at the ceiling without shifting his gaze, or grunting, uh-huh, when I know that he's not really listening to my chatter. We mourned differently. I wore it externally, grieved openly, then through my acting. He pushed deeper into himself, like a black hole swirled inside his guts. But still, we were mourning together, and that was something. It was something we shared, something we saw in each other, like my scars were his and his were mine. Plenty of nights we found ourselves curled in bed, our heads intuitively touching, listening to the noise from the city and the sound of our breath and nothing else. We knew each other. We had each other. We saw each other, as if together we were whole, even if we weren't, of course. He'd moved out of his parents' place in December. Well, his mom's place now. She insisted. He felt more than ever that he should stay, but instead Helen, his mom, nearly shoved him out the door, ensuring that he didn't have to take care of her forever. And besides, Leo was more shell-shocked than even Ben, and was spending more nights at home with Helen, nursing a beer, or three, because he'd just turned 21 in November and could do that sort of thing legally now. Even if he hadn't been legal, at this point no one was going to stop him. So Ben leased a one-bedroom in the village with a big window overlooking the treetops of Horatio Street, and most nights we ordered in Chinese food or heated up macaroni and cheese, and I rehearsed lines for whatever scene I had due, or hovered over his shoulder while he pieced together a rough cut of Romantica. We talked about my mom. We talked about his dad. We knew neither of us would ever be the same, and that was okay. We learned that grief could be like glue, sticking us together, like veterans of war who understood only each other. Sometimes I'd read my scenes and linger in the accent, the mood of the character, long after we finished. And Ben would say some version of, "Tate, I don't want anyone other than you." And I'd rejigger my brain to bring me back to him, without the pretense, without the act. Even though, way back at the bar, dive in, that was exactly what I showed him. Tatum, the actress. Now he just wants me. Today, in Park City, I roll toward him in the crevasse in the snow my body has made. His cell phone had rung 30 minutes ago. Because Ben didn't yet have an agent, one of the chairmen of the festival had called. Ben had won Best Newcomer at Sundance. It was beyond either of our wildest expectations. "You are going to be the next big thing," I say, reaching a mittened hand over to clasp his gloved one, like I had when the snow started coming down on New Year's Eve a year and a few months ago, when we first realized that maybe this could be something real. Award-winning filmmaker Ben Livingston. God, that sounds amazing. The swell of pride courses through me, as if his success is mine, and mine is his, and together we're a double helix, DNA. His wind-chapped cheeks burn even redder.
"I feel like this was a mistake, like they're going to retract it."
"Nope," I squeeze his hand. "Not a mistake, no retraction. You gotta own this, right? How long have I been saying that?"
"Since we first met," he says,
then inches forward to kiss my nose.
"Since the very first day we met."
He kisses my nose again, and we right ourselves, sitting anchored in the snowdrift, absorbing how everything is about to change.
"I wish he were here," Ben says.
"His dad."
"I know,"
I reply.
"I think he'd be proud of me," he says, though it's a bit of a question, too.
"I'm certain he would be." He lets out his breath and mutters,
"Fuck."
"Fuck what?"
"Fuck everything,"
he says, though there is so much to celebrate.
Fuck that he's not here. Fuck that I want him to see my success. Fuck that I care about his approval, when now I can't have it anyway.
He would have been proud, Ben. He would have.
He shrugs, blinks quickly.
Don't be angry today, Bea. Not when today is a celebration.
I've seen this recently, the start of his dark spiral. He tries to keep me out of it, steer me away from his moodiness, but I am trained, literally trained at Tisch, to read people, to know them. I have my own dark spirals, of course. My mom's childhood nickname for me, Deflatum Tatum, granted because she claimed she could see the air sucked out of me along with my mood, nipping on all parts of me. Today, he seems to hear me, which he doesn't always.
I'm sorry, he says. It's just a lot.
I know, I say, because I do. Hey, I got you.
He blinks faster, then stares up at the sky and yells, Fuck! Then shakes his head and manages a smile. I brush the snow off my pants, rise, and stretch out my hand, pulling him up, though he is weightier than I. But I am stronger in some ways, the ways that have proven important recently. We stumble back to the ski condo that his mom has paid for, because Ben's day job as a literary agent's assistant pays only enough to cover his rent, and my job at the bar pays even less. We peel our damp, freezing clothes off each other and step into the steaming shower until we are skin to skin with nothing in between. Afterward, Ben puts on a tie, and I slide into my customary black tight jeans and black fitted top, and he tells me that he couldn't have done this without me.
Really, he says. This film, this award, it's because of you.
I can't take all the credit. I bat my eyelashes demurely. He laughs.
Now, Tatum Connolly, don't you go and deflect when someone gives you praise.
I puff up my chest and slip into my role, the spitfire actress, the confident companion, and take a bow.
You're right. I'd like to thank the Academy. I'd like to thank my director, Ben. But mostly, I'd like to thank myself, because I'm really such a fucking genius.
He laughs harder, and so do I, both of us relieved to find a sliver of normalcy in a world that feels so upended. Then, quieter, more shyly, I say,
Don't forget to thank me up there.
Please? I elbow him, hoping I can play it off as a joke, that I'm not needy, that I don't really care, though I do. We'd watched the Oscars together last weekend, and shrieked in horror when Susanna Memphis, her real name, forgot to thank her husband. We then spent the next 30 minutes wondering if they were about to split, if the rumors were true. It wasn't that it really mattered if Ben thanked me publicly, but what if it did? What if you had to proclaim your love aloud, on stage, to make it real?
You'll be the first name I say.
Ben kisses my neck, seeing through me. When we get to the theater on Main Street, Ben is swarmed with executives and agents and important people who want to sign him as a client, who want to set up meetings in Los Angeles and New York about future projects. He grips my hand and holds on tight, but eventually, like we're caught in the undertow of the ocean, he's tugged away from me, even when we try our best to hold on.
I'll find you, he mouths over his shoulder as he goes.
I nod and think, I hope so. Please don't forget me. The lights flicker at the awards ceremony, so I find a seat in the middle of the theater with a pulse of anxiety coursing through me, that minutes earlier bravado already fading. I gaze at these unfamiliar faces, strangers who had suddenly seen the genius in my boyfriend, and something twitches deep inside, and I wonder if he'll want me as much as he always has, now that maybe he'll recognize how special he is, and that maybe I don't deserve to stand alongside his brightness. Just as I felt back when we buried my mother, just as I feel on my worst days when I can't beat back the throb of ever-present insecurity by disguising myself as someone else. Please don't see me for what I really am, and if you do, please love me anyway. I glance around, wondering where he is in the auditorium, wishing I could see his face, find him, and beckon him to sit beside me. But it's just a swarm of Hollywood types and a few others like me, phased, stunned, trying to pretend otherwise.
I curl my fingers into a fist and press my nails into my palms, an old habit from middle school after my mom was first diagnosed, before her remission, when I'd feel myself start to cry and wouldn't want to come undone in the middle of algebra or PE or the cafeteria at lunch. I remind myself that I'm an actress, a good one, and I can put on any face that I want to. Someone is waving from the side of the aisle, and I turn to see Ben, flagging me over. I excuse myself as I press past tilted knees and annoyed faces until I reach him. What are you doing? You have to be up there any second.
I know, but I realized something, he whispers.
What?
He leans closer so only I can hear.
Marry me.
What?
He is right by my ear now, his heat electrifying.
Marry me. I don't want to do any of this without you.
What? I can't have heard correctly, and yet my stomach leaps to my throat, my heartbeat detonating within my chest cavity. That he wants me, that he is choosing me. He pulls back and stares at me with a hint of a smile, wordlessly, like I can read his mind. We'd discussed marriage in tangential terms, like maybe one day, like let's put it out there at some point, but nothing concrete, nothing that ever felt like it could be real.
Marry me. Tomorrow. Next year. Whenever. Just say yes.
Okay, I say, because my mouth hasn't yet caught up with my brain, with its frenetic euphoria that wants to burst with a yes. He raises his eyebrows.
Okay.
Okay, yes! I giggle loudly enough that a few people hiss for me to pipe down. I clamp my hand over my mouth, but my smile is wider than the whole of it. He removes his father's tarnished wedding band, which they miraculously recovered in the rubble, and which he's been wearing on his right index finger, and slides it over my thumb, the only finger it fits.
Can this do for now? We'll get you a real one when we're back.
It's more than okay, I say. It's perfect. Later, when his name is called and he rises to accept his award, true to his word, the first person he thanks is me.
9. Ben, May 2012. I sink beneath the bubbles in the hot tub and wonder, if I stay under long enough, can I force myself to drown? Not that I want to drown, necessarily. But it's not that I don't, either. I float my hands toward my face. My fingers and gold wedding band weave in front of me like an apparition. I count to 20, holding my breath, swooshing my arms at my sides to keep me under the too hot water. But as my lungs grow tighter, I find that I don't have it in me to sink, to not stretch for a gasp of air. The flats of my feet find the bottom of the jacuzzi and I shoot upward, toward the open sky, toward the California sunshine. Tatum appears on our back deck now, on the phone, pacing in a circle, her forehead knotted into something that signals a crisis. But what constitutes a crisis, anyway? That the test screeners to Army Women 2.0 aren't positive? That her publicist has overbooked her interviews? Bad press for forgetting to thank me in speeches? I buckle my knees and head beneath the surface again. Even from my perch below the bubbles, I can see her scanning the pool for me, and I know I should reach out a hand, hold up a foot, to let her know that I am here and alive and breathing. But I don't. Instead, I count to 30 this time, until my lungs burn. And when I think that I absolutely can't take it for another second, I hold on, and I do. Tatum's ankles draw me upward. She's standing on the ledge of the hot tub, and then she is crouched over, waving me north. "It's Joey!" she shouts, her face and voice and body language sharp like a blade's edge. "Get out! He's at Cedars! Broke his arm, hit his head!" She stands abruptly. "Hurry up! I won't wait for you!" What she means is, "You spend half your time trying to drown yourself now, literally, metaphorically, whatever. I can't rescue someone who ties bricks to his ankles, who doesn't even attempt to swim." She's not wrong. Tatum is rarely wrong. Since Leo, I sleep too long, though fitfully. I work too little and not well. I pick fights with her and with Eric, who finally said, "Dude, maybe it's time you quit." And I did. I flip off drivers on the freeway for innocuous lane changes. I snap at the woman in Starbucks for taking forever to decide what to put in her stupid latte. Does it really matter? How much of this shit really matters? I heave myself out of the hot tub, throw on my jeans, slide into my flip-flops. I feel myself moving through quicksand as everything else meteors past. Tatum drives because she is better at outpacing the paparazzi, who sit outside our house now waiting for a wave or a glimpse or some interesting nugget about what makes this day any different from all the other days that they trailer. Oscar winner Tatum Connolly. I am an asterisk, an afterthought. Her husband of 9 years, who used to be something great, but now just look at his IMDb to see what he's done, because no one could really tell you. One season of Code Emergency, that shitty NBC procedural which does okay in the ratings but isn't exactly mentally taxing, before he had some sort of breakdown in the writer's room one afternoon, in which he heaved the In-N-Out Burgers, the writing staff's dinner, against the giant whiteboard that was littered with crappy plot lines, and then after the burgers, the milkshakes, and some fries, too, until the whiteboard was nothing but a smashed canvas of inedible garbage, at which Ben proclaimed, "Well, at least now the plot lines match the quality of the show." And Eric, his producing partner, said, "Dude, let's go to a bar and talk." That's the sort of anecdote you might find on his IMDb page. Joey is with his teacher, Ms. Ashley, when we arrive at the hospital. My hair is still damp, the water still floating through my ears. I handle the paperwork while Tatum rushes into the exam room. By the time I filled out the insurance forms, Tatum has soothed him into a quiet whimper. And Ms. Ashley, after explaining he fell off the monkey bars at the playground and landed with his arm pinned beneath him, has returned to Windstream, the preschool of the Hollywood elite, amid multiple apologies and promises to call later this afternoon. The nurses have checked his vitals, which seem stable, but they need to get him down to X-ray to check on the break, and they want to monitor him for a possible concussion since he's got a welt the size of the hard-boiled egg Tatum ate for breakfast on the back of his head. She's eating only protein for 2 meals a day now. "We're going to wheel you down to radiology, sweetie," the nurse says. "We're going to take a picture of your insides."
"Okay,"
Joey whispers.
"Can I see them too?"
"You betcha," she smiles. Then to us, "The doctor will be in to see you after she reviews everything."
"Can I go with him?" Tatum asks. "To the x-rays?"
"One parent can tag along," the nurse replies, "though I promise he's in good hands."
"I know. My mom was a nurse."
She loses herself to a memory that she doesn't share, which should make me bristle, but does not. I haven't earned her confidence recently. I don't deserve her secrets now. Shame rises through me at how unavailable I've been for her, but then drains just as quickly. Though she's been there, literally been there, for my harder moments, she hasn't been entirely present either. So maybe we deserve the half effort we get from one another in this pocket of time. Maybe this is the best we have.
ER nurse? "Obstetrics," Tatum says. "I know the hospital runs on you guys, but I'm his mom."
I watch her, unable to read her in the way that I used to, unable to see exactly what she is thinking, where her actress persona ends and Tatum, my wife, begins.
"Mom always helps," the nurse says, smiling, "but no phones in that ward."
Tatum hands me her cell phone.
"I was supposed to do a call with everyone. If Luann texts, tell her I don't know when I'll be free."
"Okay," I say. Luann is her publicist. Her team is everyone. Tatum doesn't have to remind me that she plays the part of Supermom well. That even if she is traveling for weeks on end, a press junket from London to Paris, to Rome, to Berlin, or even if she embodies people she is not, loses herself to accents and tics and character traits that unintentionally ebb into her own personality, she will show up and be accountable for Joey, be his backbone when he needs her. I will too. He's the one thing that we both do easily, equally. Though to be fair to both of us, for the past 6 months, since Leo and the Oscars, I've spent a decent portion of my days wondering how much it will hurt if I drown myself. The nurse and Tatum ease Joey into a wheelchair. And Tatum, not the nurse, steers him out of the room toward radiology. Hang in there, kiddo, I say before the door closes behind them. You're going to be good as new. I drop my head into my hands, sink my elbows atop my knees. Tears come almost immediately, which is no surprise. I'm stripped bare now, a walking open wound. How long does it take to mourn the person you swore you'd protect? Forever. It feels like I will mourn Leo forever. It's different from the grief with my dad, and it's different from the grief with Tatum's mom. She concedes this, even as she tries to be helpful.
Let's find a therapist. Why won't you talk to me about it?
I should have done something to stop it, seen something to help my baby brother. I should have known. But I didn't, and now he's gone. And my son has a silly accident like slipping off the monkey bars and breaks his arm, and I'm reduced to sobbing in a halogen-lit hospital room because I carry around my grief like a boulder, unable to ever find a resting place, unable to forgive myself for not being a better, more present, more forgiving big brother. My phone buzzes in my pocket, startling me. Spencer, wondering when I'd like to start working again. I delete the email, wipe my cheeks, try to compose myself. I close my eyes, drop my head back against the wall, and wait. I'm nearly asleep when a knock rattles the door. The doctor, with her red hair high in a ponytail and studious black glasses, is examining Joey's chart with a furrowed brow. Then her eyes move up to mine.
Oh my God, she says. I thought the name...
Oh my God, I say. I knew the red hair looked too familiar, that her dancer's posture was like a shadow of an old friend. Something electric runs through me for the first time in so long. I don't pay close enough attention to examine it, what this feeling is, what it means, if I should lean in and touch the live wire, if I should instead run. She laughs and shakes her head in disbelief.
Ben, Jesus, I haven't seen you since...
The Plaza Altenay. We say in unison. Then, Amanda, it's recklessness, that feeling. Now it comes alive. God, it's been forever. Joey's still getting his x-rays, I say, after we've stumbled over our hellos.
Sorry about that, he was supposed to be back by now,
she says, tilting her glasses to rest atop her head, so she looks no older than when we loved each other a million years ago. But we split, and now here I am, married with a kid, in a gasp of a moment, a prolonged heartbeat.
Today is a mess here. I'm covering for two other pediatricians who couldn't make it in. The timing's off all over the place.
Timing never was our forte, I say, more boldly than I meant to. But then, maybe exactly the amount of boldness that I intended. I haven't felt something like this in too long. A spark, a fire. So, while I might tell myself that I don't mean to flirt with my old girlfriend who left me for a residency in San Francisco, I know that plenty of things we tell ourselves are untrue. Like that I'm not responsible for Leo's death. Like I haven't intentionally cratered my career because nothing felt important after Leo. Like Tatum might be growing weary of me. Like I have stopped trying to read her, in small ways. Like if her smile for the nurse today was genuine. And in larger ways, too. And I haven't done anything to change it. I tell myself all sorts of lies every day, so this one, that I don't mean to overstep with Amanda, is just another on my list. Another way I betray myself. Another way that I test Tatum, too. Would she notice that I spent the afternoon flirting with my old girlfriend? Would she sense it on me like a dog smells fetid garbage, like she once would have? Amanda grins.
I always wondered if I'd run into you here. Not here, here, at Cedars, but L.A.
She shrugs.
I guess it's a big city. And you're married now. To Tatum Connolly. My God, I never had a chance.
Hey, I say, you're the one who broke my heart.
If I recall, you broke up with me.
Oh, you know, beating you to the punch and all of that. It's not like I didn't sit and cry myself to sleep that whole first summer. Also, lots of alcohol was involved.
But then you got over me.
She smiles. Only because my endless weeping was seriously crimping my rebound sex. She laughs, and I do too. A dormant staccato rising up from my chest, bouncing off the beige exam room walls. How about you? I ask. Where are you on a scale of single to rebound to commitment? Jesus, a loaded question if there ever was one. I'm shocked at my brazenness, more shocked at how easily it comes.
Oh, well, still single. Engaged once, but that didn't stick.
She glances to the floor.
I don't know. I guess being a doctor pretty much takes up most of my life. And I have all these kids. My patients.
No, I reply, because I'm suddenly nervous. Not that I've exposed too much, or that she has, but that just as quickly there is an unexpected tension. The tension of possibility between us.
Don't feel sorry for me. There are little frozen Amandas sitting in a laboratory not far from here, ready and waiting for that perfect specimen of sperm.
She blushes and holds a hand to her face.
Shit, sorry. I always overshare when I'm uncomfortable.
I remember. I smile. And I don't mean to make you uncomfortable. God, not at all. Sorry, that's on me. I've been a bit of an emotional sieve recently. I flop my arm. I apologize.
You were always such a fucking nice guy.
She sighs.
I thought that would bore me, but it turns out the nice guys are harder to find than I thought. More valuable, I mean.
I'm really not that nice. I should say, just ask my wife. I turn the light out before she can come to bed. I ignore her requests to write a script just for her. I leave the room when my mom calls and Tatum holds the receiver out to me, because I am petty and childish now that my mom has a new husband, Ron, and a new life where they take cruises in the Mediterranean and have a membership to the tennis club near the summer home they're renting in Connecticut. I'm still here. I'm still stuck. Leo is gone, and I have lost myself with him.
Well, Tatum's lucky. That's all I mean. I'm sure she knows that.
Amanda exhales and seems to consider something. I fiddle with my wedding band and worry what else she'll say, what else she has heard. What will break me from this foreign bubble of happiness? As if she can read my cues as well as Tatum can, or used to, she says,
"Well, this is a happy accident. I mean, not that I wanted your son to break his arm, just, you know. Anyway, I think he's going to be okay. I'll check his x-rays, of course, but these things on kids manage to heal faster than you'd think."
She slows her rambling, inhales, smiles.
"Wow, your son... that kind of blows my mind."
Trust me, me too. I smile back, working muscles that have nearly atrophied.
Anyway, they'll bring him back from radiology, and I'll let you know. We may need to keep him here overnight to rule out a concussion.
Okay, I say. I'll stay as long as it takes. She grabs the door handle to leave, then hesitates.
Look, I don't know...
She pulls a card from the front pocket of her lab coat.
"Take this. If you ever want to, like, catch up, give me a call."
I stare at the card for a second too long. It feels like a dare. It feels like an alarm that I should run from.
"Or don't,"
she says, blood rising to her cheeks again.
"God, this is unprofessional. Sorry."
"Don't be sorry," I say.
"Okay,"
she replies.
"Then I'm not."
10. Tatum. March 2003. We marry in Santa Barbara in March. Neither of us wanted much of a to-do. I'd have been happy at City Hall, and Ben is so busy now that he is Hollywood's it boy that, through no fault of his own, he couldn't involve himself in more than showing up.
"I will show up very enthusiastically," he says, before throwing me atop the duvet and kissing my neck. "But the flowers, the cake, I don't care. Only care about the woman waiting for me at the end of the aisle."
But after the wreckage of the previous year, his dad, my mom, it felt like we owed something more to our families. Well, to his mom, Helen, and to Leo, and to Piper, my sister. And if giving them a wedding also gave them something to be happy about, it was a small concession. Not a concession, it was a celebration. But the typical trappings of a formal wedding weren't for me. Not without my mom here anyway. And maybe even if she'd been here, not then either. I take a week off work. I'm the Tuesday to Saturday bartender at P.F. Chang's on Wilshire, and Ben shutters his laptop and his trips back and forth to the studio where they are finalizing the reshoots for All the Men with the hopes of having it prepped for the Toronto Film Festival this fall. Since landing in L.A. 9 months ago, our lives, well, Ben's life, has spun into a whirlwind. Mine mostly consists of pouring cosmos for tourists and snacking on bar nuts with Mariana, my bartending cohort, and also an aspiring actress. Ben and I promise ourselves that we can press pause for a 5-day sliver of time to marry. Though P.F. Chang's is my paycheck, I am stuffed with classes, workshops, mailings to agents and managers, and anyone who will have me. I went to goddamn Tisch, but no one out here seems to notice all that much. Maybe if my breasts were bigger, or my vibe more available. I don't know. Mariana says the only people who make it in their first year are the rich kids with connections, like the Spielberg kids or whatever. So I don't tell her that my fiancé is making it in his first year, because I'm not sure that I want her to point out that he's a rich kid with connections. Or maybe I'm not sure that I want to believe that Ben wouldn't have made it regardless. It's not that I don't dream of becoming P.F. Chang's Employee of the Month, I said to her a few weeks ago. Oh, babe, I hear you. I was Ms. January, and let me tell you, it's the stuff dreams are made of. She laughed. Daisy, my best friend from Tisch, flies in from New York for the wedding, packing in a few auditions for the week. Rich kid with connections, and a hodgepodge of Ben's high school friends jet out, too, landing in L.A., but then driving to Santa Barbara to stay at the Biltmore, or the swanky boutique hotels tucked into the sides of mountains where celebrities unwind for the weekend. In the 9 months since we left New York, Ben and I have planted roots in a rental bungalow on Ocean Avenue in Santa Monica, and Piper heads out 3 days before the wedding to stay in the guest room, Ben's office, and help me prepare, though there isn't much to do. Helen found a woman in Santa Barbara who coordinates beach weddings for a living, and I've merely had to reply to emails with things like, full bar, lilies not roses, salmon sounds fine, and that's that.
You seem so unexcited, Piper said the morning before we were set to drive north for the event.
We were walking along the beach, just a stone's throw from the condo complex. From my bedroom window, I could see the horizon, the towering palm trees, the stairway leading downward to the path on which we now walked.
You're happy, right?
Of course I'm happy, I said, sliding off my flip-flops, stepping from the concrete boardwalk onto the cold sand. It was a gloomy morning, the skies overcast and low.
Like, if it were my wedding, I'd be way more into it. I just feel like the wedding stuff is stupid. I just want to get going, live my life.
She plopped onto the sand, reminding me of how gangly she was as a toddler, always tumbling down, scraping her knees, skinning her palms. Maybe it's no surprise that she's a nurse now, just like my mom was.
Do you think Mom and Dad were happy?
She craned her neck toward me. I was startled by the question, felt a hiccup in my heart. Dad was a drunk, I said. I don't know how you live with that. She shook her head.
Before that. Like now, when they were just about to get married, like you. She must have loved him as much as you love Ben, right?
I scanned the ocean, the waves riotous and angry. I didn't want to think about how my marriage could be like my parents, or how Ben could be like my dad. Not that he was. Not that they were anything close.
I don't know, Pipes. I guess. Maybe. I think every marriage must start off hopeful, right? You know she forgave him for everything at the end.
Her voice caught.
You know he was back home with her. I mean, with us by then.
What she meant was, we all forgave him, can't you? Or maybe what she meant was, everyone screws up, in marriage, too. It felt important to Piper that I believed my parents were happy, so I said,
they must have loved each other as much as they thought they could.
I guess that's all you can know, right? I can't measure my love for Ben against Mom's love for Dad because it's not like you can quantify these things. It's not like I can pour them into a cup and see which one measures more.
Remember all those snow globes you and Mom collected?
Of course, I said.
It feels like marriage should be like that, trapped inside, but in a good way, with sparkles raining down and protecting you.
I don't think that marriage is really anything like that. She sighed.
It would be nice if it could be, though. Just all that time together, knowing each other inside and out.
I wanted to say, I don't know that you can ever know somebody inside and out, and I certainly don't want Ben to know all of my ugly insides. Nearly all of them, yes, but every last ugliness? Probably not. Would he love me enough then? Would I love him? He tells me you don't have to be a role or stop pretending when he catches me slipping into someone who I'm not, and I do, or at least I try to, because Ben wants to see me, the whole of me, and when he does, he still loves me. But it's not like there isn't still wiggle room to fall into a cloudier place wearing my masks, not like old habits can be shed in a single moment. I said to Piper, "Sure. That does sound nice." I'm quiet on the drive up to Santa Barbara. Ben and Piper play I Spy, even though no one has played it since we were children, but they are silly and bored, and we hit a bad patch of traffic that grates on my nerves, but doesn't faze Ben, because he's not mired in the question, does he love me enough? I know I do him, and inherently I know that he does me too. He doesn't string me along like Eddie from college, who constantly dumped me for his girlfriend back home and then offered vague platitudes that made me forgive him. Doesn't invalidate my sexuality or feelings like Aaron in high school, who stripped me of my virginity. He is respectful. He is kind. He is loving. He is smart. He is everything I could have envisioned for myself and more. But what if, like my own parents, something changes? We change. Then, will he still love me enough? The car creeps forward in the traffic, and Piper's voice grates on me, as if I am physically bristling at her for even planting this notion, this seed of insecurity in me. Will he love me forever? Love me like he does now, when he thinks he sees everything about me, but maybe he hasn't? "I see you," he says to me all the time. What he means is, "I love you." But what happens when it gets uglier? Will I still look the same? My insides? My outsides?
I spy with my little eye a fiancé who is looking like she sucked on a lemon, I hear Ben say, and Piper's piercing laughter rings out from the back seat.
He brings me to, brings me back, like only he can. I turn and roll my eyes at him.
Sometimes my mom used to call her Deflatum Tatum, Piper laughs, because her mood would just go, poof.
Deflatum Tatum, Ben howls.
Excuse me, I say. It is this ability to tap into all sorts of emotions that will one day win me an Oscar.
Now that I believe, Ben says, still grinning.
He eases his hand off the wheel and squeezes my thigh.
But no bad moods allowed in this car.
It's the traffic.
You live in L.A. now, baby.
He says this in his slickest, slimiest producer voice, and I descend into my own fit of laughter. He glances from the road toward me and winks.
I see you. I exhale. Of course we love each other enough. How could I even doubt that for a moment? We are not my parents. There isn't a measuring cup for our love. Helen has rented us a suite at the Biltmore, and though I asked her not to, paid for Piper and my father as well. I told Ben how uncomfortable this made me, and he said,
"Babe, I know, you've worked since you were 12, but it's just a weekend, and it's just to make it go smoother for all of us, so let's let it go for now, and this will be the last time we accept such a thing, okay?"
And because he is pragmatic and kind, I, of course, let it go. He likes taking care of me, being my alpha. I'm the one who isn't used to being taken care of. My dad is shuffling around the lobby when we pull up in Ben's Toyota, and Piper says,
"Be nice, Tate. Please, just be nice."
So I kiss his cheek and try to pretend that when I get close, I'm not sniffing for alcohol. He looks sober, though, clean. He reaches for me and pulls me tighter than I'd like and says,
"I wish so much she were here. She'd want to be here so badly."
He is crying already, so I press myself back from him. "Dad, please, come on. No tears today."
And he nods and sniffles, and then Piper is at his elbow, asking brightly if he's already checked in, and maybe he wants to take a walk? Ben rolls our bags to our suite, which is covered in rose petals, and makes us both sigh, because I hate roses, as did my mom, and then giggle, because Helen has tried so hard, and it's a little funny that our bed has been showered in something I loathe so deeply. Ben whisks them off the bed with a sweep of his arms, then tugs his clothes off nearly as quickly, jumps on stark naked, and says, "Now this is a better view, am I right?" I sleep fitfully that night until he presses himself next to me, nearly swallowing me against him, and then, when I can hear his heartbeat in my ear, I tumble towards sleep, as if his pulse is soothing mine, as if his heart is also assuring mine. We don't need to measure our love, not when our hearts can beat in rhythm, not when they can beat in tandem, as if they are one and the same. It is unusually sunny the next day. You never know what you will get by the ocean in March, but for us it is cloudless, sky blue. I take this as a sign. I wear my mother's veil. My dad behaves himself, though I opt to walk down the aisle alone. Piper, as my maid of honor, holds my bouquet of lilies, Mom's favorite, and passes me a tissue when I find myself weeping when Ben says his vows. Leo, as Ben's best man, winks at me when I try to gather myself together, which makes me choke, then laugh, then cry harder, and so then Leo starts laughing, and Ben turns toward him, and Ben starts laughing, and soon all of us together have broken down into uncontrollable gales that echo over the beach waves just yards away. Though it is not the wedding I planned, Helen took care of all the details, it is perfect. We are perfect. Ben's cheeks are sun-kissed, and his eyes aglow, and he cries when he kisses me, and lofts our hands joyfully when the officiant declares us husband and wife, and I gaze at my husband and this menagerie of people who have stood up to celebrate us, and I realize that if we did measure our happiness, our love for each other, we would be full. Daisy finds me by the bar after the ceremony. "Please tell me that you're at least taking a few days for a honeymoon." I stir my martini. Ben has to work. They're aiming for Toronto. He should just cast you, like you're not the best actress he could find. I shake my head. I want to do this on my own merits, not because I'm Ben Livingston's wife. Everyone in this town uses their connections. Christ, look at me. It would be different if he wrote something just for me or whatever. I don't want him wedging me into a project just because. I'll pass. "Your call," she says. "But there are easier paths to becoming a star." I shrug as if to say, let's talk about something else. Not that there is much to discuss anyway. Though we've been in Los Angeles for only 9 months, I can barely muster commercial auditions, and even those haven't gone well. I am never pretty, only cute. Or I am too pretty, but they want cuter. Or I am too tall, or too short, or too flat-chested, or too brunette. I am too much of everything but what they want, it seems. But I meant it. It wasn't Ben's job to find me work. It was mine. Had been since I was 12, and it isn't any different now. Jesus, Tate, come on, what happened to that fire from back in the bar? The girl who wouldn't turn down a bet, Daisy says. I poke at an olive and pop it in my mouth. That girl was a roll, Daisy. Give me a break, like you don't know that. Also, L.A. is fucking hard. Everyone out here is beautiful and aspiring. But you have more talent in your pinky than they do. I shrug again. Tatum, you were the best one in our graduating class. You were the one who won raves in Romantica. None of the rest of us. Only because you got sick. She shakes her head. No. No, Professor Sherman always gave you the harder work, always handed you the trickier parts, because he was a hard ass. No, she says, squeezing my shoulders, because you were the best. How did you not know that? Easy for you to say. Praise was never my strong suit, perhaps because my dad gave me so little of it, perhaps because my mom was so overly effusive that her endless compliments came to mean nothing, were just jumbles of words. You're already, like, taking Broadway by storm. Off-Broadway, she says. And, by the way, it's basically for minimum wage. It's gotta beat the tip jar at P.F. Chang's, I say. Well, I still think he owes you a honeymoon. It's the least he could do for making you lose that bet. She winks, then dips her fingers into my drink and pulls out the remaining olive. Also, to bring this back to yours truly, I think you have me to thank for this. A, the bet. B, getting the chicken pox. I'll be sure to thank you in my acceptance speech, I say with a grin. Assholes who don't give credit to the people who get them there are the worst. Daisy sticks out her tongue. Blech. She makes a retching noise. Ooh, so you'll also have to thank that ex-girlfriend. If she had stuck around New York, who knows what would have happened? Amanda. I make my own retching sound. But no talk of ex-girlfriends tonight. You're right. She nods and pulls me closer for a hug. You guys were meant for each other. No one is more meant for each other than you and Ben. My cup runneth over, I say. Daisy motions for the bartender, and we toast to my good fortune.
11. Ben. February 2011. My face hurts from smiling, and I hate that I'm aware of this. I'm happy for Tatum, but the press line on the red carpet is endless, and her publicity team keeps shuttling me to the side for each interview, escorting me to the back when the photographers called out for a single. Single meaning just her. Single meaning all the ways she outshines me. I'm not throwing a pity party. It's simply true. Tatum has ascended above me in all the ways that matter to this town. I'm sorry, she'll say each time she's swept off into that photographer's sea. It doesn't mean anything other than they want a shot of my dress. But it's hard not to feel like she's splintering off from me, leaving me behind. I wave to Eric, who is on the arm of a producer he's been dating, as I wait for her to wrap another interview. Ryan Seacrest now, fawning, making her spin in a circle. The racket on the carpet is too loud to hear the two of them, but I see Tatum throw her head back into a completely realistic cackle, and I wonder if I'm the only person out here who knows that she's faking it. I still know her, still love her, still see her, which I think she both values and demands. This is nuts, Eric says as he weaves his way toward me. He's grown a goatee in the 2 weeks since I've seen him. I've had no time for my own friends or my own work since I've been out with Tatum at industry events each night. Nice goatee, I say. All the A-listers are doing it, he grins. Which makes us A-list adjacent, I guess. On our best days, he laughs. On our best days, dude. I shrug. No room for the plebeian TV folks here. A, we're not plebeian TV folks. Code Emergency is gonna kill it. And B, you're with the Night's Only Sure Thing, so take up a little more space. Tatum's publicist waves me onward. Gotta hop. Duty calls. Find me at a party later. Save me, more like. I expect you to be working the room, he says. Selling the shit out of code. Noted, I nod, losing him as the crowd folds behind me. Of course, I have no intention of talking up our new network deal at Fox, the one that guarantees us a full season of Code Emergency, set to air this coming March. TV is not film, even when Tatum says that she's proud of me, even when the paycheck is lucrative. Code Emergency is formulaic hospital stuff. Not what I had envisioned when I was hailed as Hollywood's It Boy. Not the stuff I'd imagined when I pieced together Romantica, or when I was wooed to L.A., riding on my carpet of fairy dust, and penned All the Men or One Day in Dallas. Some days, when I'm feeling even less generous with myself, I wonder what my father would say. Not that I'm not a grown-up, not that I should still heave around daddy issues, much less dead daddy issues. But still, yes, sometimes I hear his voice rattling around. Wondering why I'm marooned in the middle instead of scrambling toward the top. Other than Tatum, my ambition has been the only thing I've held steady since film school. To abandon that means, essentially, that I have failed. Tatum would tell me this is crazy, that I'm echoing my father. But Tatum is ambitious in her own ways, so to tell me to quell my own lust for success is senseless, hypocritical. I've tried to get back into film. It's not as if I haven't. But you can only have so many flops in this town, or so many scripts put into turnaround, before you're relegated elsewhere. TV. Network TV, if you're really hurting. If you can dream it, you can be it, Tatum tells me. Which years ago she used as her own mantra. And it used to be kind of cute. The kind of thing that I'd tease her about and then throw her over my shoulder and cart her to the bedroom. But now it just makes me bristle. It's not as if I don't want it, I say. It's not like I'm not trying.
I didn't mean it that way, she'll say. You're misinterpreting.
On the carpet, Tatum wraps the interview and glides toward me, blowing out her cheeks, widening her eyes.
God, I have 20 more of these, and I've already run out of ways to be charming. Save me.
You're much more charming than I am, so I wouldn't know how if I could. I kiss her forehead. A photographer will snap us in this pose, and we'll appear to be the picture of happiness. Sometimes we are. Lily Marple taps her shoulder before we can be herded to the next talking head.
Darling,
Lily says, tilting forward to air kiss both of Tatum's cheeks.
Ben?
She raises her eyebrows, which I know Tatum sees, and which I also know will irk her the evening through, even though her life is about to change times infinity.
I just wanted to wish you luck,
Lily says.
Thank you.
Every one of Tatum's muscles is frozen except for the one squeezing my hand. She hasn't forgotten, all these years later, how Lily shoved her hands down my pants on One Day in Dallas, how Lily thought she could take what she wanted because she was a star, and how what Lily wanted was me. I didn't bite, of course, which is why it was easy to laugh about it when I told Tatum, until I realized she wasn't laughing.
I mean it,
Lily says, lowering her eyes.
I know we're not friendly, and I know that our rivalry sells a lot of magazines, but I wish you luck. I wish you success. I wish you only good things.
Thank you, Tatum says again.
We should put this behind us,
Lily offers, and she strikes me as genuine, like a once young upstart who learned that being an asshole gets you nowhere. Or at least makes you no friends. Since Lily and I work together, she has gone just about everywhere a career can go, trailed only by Tatum. I watch Lily now, debating how honest she's being with her truce offering. She is also an excellent actress, and with excellent actresses you never can tell. It occurs to me that perhaps I should start to wonder as much about Tatum.
Okay,
Tatum says, not at all genuine, like someone who can hold a grudge forever. My gut relaxes just a bit. I can still read her. She is not as foreign to me as Lily. Lily grasps her hand.
I voted for you, doll.
The photographers sniff out their union from behind their press barricade and start shouting their names. Lily and Tatum, give us a smile. Show us some leg. Just you two ladies. Just you two. The publicity team yanks me out of the shots, tucks me back into the corners where the plus ones belong. I admire Tatum from my perch to the side. Tonight she is almost too beautiful to look at, even though I've looked at her for years now. She is in a beaded, strapless gold gown that somehow turns her green eyes almost violet, and her skin iridescent. Still, she is too skinny, as she always is now.
Skinny photographs better,
she says, her collarbone protruding, her back a string of knife edges. But I've also grown used to the way that her hip bones jut out when I reach for them, how the curve of her belly is nearly concave, such that you'd never know it was once swollen with joy and beautiful. Tonight, even beside Lily, who is alluring and sensuous in her own way, though I am certain to never breathe a word of this aloud, Tatum is a star in every context of the word. Glittering, golden, ethereal. Finally her publicist barks,
enough,
and whisks her to the next interview, then the one after that. And then after an endless ocean of sycophantic reporters and executives and hangers-on, we wade toward the lobby of the theater. You ready? I whisper in her ear. Her lips find mine in reply, lingering for a beat as she calms herself. I linger for a beat, too. My wife isn't Lily Marple. She is still transparent to me, regardless of the masks she puts on for her roles, for the lavishing press, for her adoring fans.
I'm so fucking nervous, she says, pulling back. You would think I could get a grip.
I see you, I say, like I used to all the time. I'm here. Which surprises me as much as it may surprise her. I know that I have dragged my feet to some of these parties, that I have let my ego too easily be bruised when an exec brushes past me for someone more important. That this is her moment, and while most of me has championed her, perhaps the whole of me hasn't, because I've been too stupid and too insecure not to be a small bit competitive. I know that she can see me calculating. Why her, not me? As if there is only so much success to go around. I tell myself it's not about her. I'm not that guy who cares that his wife lives larger than he does. It's about my missed potential, about half-realized dreams that remind me of all the ways my cup can still be filled. It's about watching Tatum live up to all of her potential while realizing how much of mine I've wasted. About landing in L.A. as Hollywood's next great thing and now penning a shitty network hospital drama. Some of that wasn't my fault. Scripts were put in turnaround, finished cuts weren't as well received as we'd hoped they'd be. Some of it was on me, though. How personally I took the rejection and the poor reviews. How much my work suffered after my dad died. As if I kept trying harder and harder to please him and it was only backfiring with all the effort. How I was still the kid showing off his French at the Louvre to get his dad's approval. Only now that was impossible. How I never could get Reagan right, though not for lack of trying. I didn't used to be this way. At least, I don't think so. Or maybe it's just that as a rich kid out of Dalton and then Williams for college, everything was realized for me. Because that's the sort of path that's paved for you when you're a rich kid out of Dalton and Williams. Sometimes I'll find myself watching Tatum at one of these endless industry parties where she kisses cheeks and laughs in that way that only I know is fake and hugs acquaintances like they're best friends. And I'll resent her for all of it. And then I'll rewind and try to pinpoint when I became so cynical, when I became such a dick. It's not like I don't know what I am. But I'll forgive myself for that too. Because how can I not still be a little angry over the way he died? What the 19 men on those planes took from me? The way it left us? How it wrecked Leo? How it unmoored me? How my mom found someone new and moved on as if this weren't the ultimate blight on my hope of normalcy? How I'd never write a script that was good enough for him or win the Oscar like I promised him because he wouldn't be around anyway? How I'd never have the chance to forgive him for the way he pushed me, for the way he goaded me. And, yes, for the way he inspired me, too. To be the best. To expect the best. Now I was simply left with a void of that, of the best. And in this void all of my best had suffered. It was years back now, and not something I dwell on. But the wreckage of his death ruined me maybe more than it should have, and ruined my work along with it. None of that is Tatum's fault. That dark seed inside of me has nothing to do with her. But still, when I watch her glide through a room as if she's lit by a spotlight and wonder, why her, not me? Just like I've wondered a million times in the shadowy corners of my grief about my dad, and how these seeds flare up with Ron and Walter now, too. Why my dad, not someone else? It's hard not to be resentful all the same. Tonight, I try harder. I kiss her again and say, you're gonna be great. You have your speech? She nods and then exhales and reaches for my hand. And we sail through the lobby toward Tatum's destiny. And I remind myself to enjoy it, to savor it, to champion it. Because this is the stuff that dreams are made of. If we open up wide enough to let those dreams in. My phone starts vibrating on the commercial break before Tatum's category. I check it. My mom. I drop it back in my tux pocket. While others are flitting about the theater, clutching hands, making deals, Tatum is sitting stone still, trying to compose herself. Almost there, I say. Try to enjoy it. Tatum had won every major award leading up to this. There would be no upset, no surprise. In exactly 3 minutes, she'll float up to the stage and accept her Oscar. My phone buzzes again, then quiets, then buzzes again. Shit, my mom won't stop calling.